Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 29th of October, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has again failed to trigger a general election, and the deadline for Brexit has been pushed back to January. Senior US military figures are unable to confirm President Donald Trump's description of Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's death. Plus, a scientific breakthrough that promises to transform our understanding of time and space. Also in this podcast...
If you're in the mandatory evacuation zone and you're still there watching this, you're an idiot. Get the hell out.
Wildfires continue to cause destruction and havoc in Northern California. And Hollywood remembers one of its most flamboyant and controversial film producers, Robert Evans, who's died at the age of 89. We start here in the UK, where the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has again failed to secure enough support for a general election as the torturous agony of Britain's withdrawal from the European Union continues. Mr. Johnson wanted a vote on December the 12th to try, in his words, to get Brexit done. Since entering Downing Street in July, he's insisted that the UK would leave the EU this Thursday, that's the 31st of October, do or die. But the EU has granted a three-month extension to Brexit, pushing the deadline back to January 2020. This was Mr. Johnson in the House of Commons before the vote, urging MPs from all sides to back a pre-Christmas election.
Across the country, there is a widespread view that this Parliament has run its course. And that is because I simply do not believe that this House is capable of delivering on the priorities of the people, whether that means Brexit or anything else.
And this was the response of the Labour opposition leader, Jeremy Corbyn.
He said that he would never ask for an extension, and he said he'd rather die in a ditch. Another broken promise. Mr. Speaker, every promise this Prime Minister makes, he abandons.
So, MPs have rejected Mr. Johnson's election timeline. But does that spell an end to it? I asked our political correspondent, Naomi Grimley.
As soon as we heard the result, Boris Johnson made it clear he's going to make another bid to get a 12th of December election, this time by drawing up a very short bill that he'll try to get through Parliament. And this time he's hoping that two of the opposition parties, the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party, back him, as they've indicated they would like an early election, though in a twist, they wanted on the 9th of December. So the big question is, will they agree on something in the next couple of days?
And why is that more likely to be voted through?
Lib Dems and the Scottish National Party say they want it on the 9th. Partly they say it's to do with making sure that Boris Johnson cannot bring his withdrawal agreement, his Brexit plan, back to the House of Commons and try to get that through. There simply won't be time if there is a 9th of December election. They'll have to dissolve Parliament later this week. So that's their reasoning. Possibly, I think, Val, they may end up coming up with a date in between those, you know, perhaps the 10th or the 11th. So it certainly looks like it's possible Britain will still get a December election. But it's also possible that if they just can't agree, it then it's more likely in January or February.
So it's definitely going to happen at some point, do you think?
I think there's a clear indication now from everyone, even Jeremy Corbyn, whose main opposition Labour Party abstained in the vote tonight. Even they say they want a general election and they agree it's necessary. The question is, everyone's sort of gaming it politically. That's part of the problem. So, for example, some are even thinking, well, where will students be in December? Will they be at home or will they be in their university towns? It's things like that that are getting in the way. Certainly, it feels like one is in the offing sooner rather than later.
Naomi Grimley. Now to the Iraqi capital, Baghdad, where the authorities have declared a nighttime curfew after the fourth consecutive day of anti-government protests. More than 70 people have been killed so far, and the Independent High Commission for Human Rights says as many as 3,500 people have been injured. To find out what it's like on the streets, the BBC's Chloe Tilley spoke to an Iraqi woman called Naveen, who joined the protests.
They shot at us with hot water. We got shot with tear gas. We got shot with live bullets. We're getting shot at. We're getting attacked. People are dying left and right. Like, I've witnessed a lot of dead bodies right in front of me.
While you've been protesting, they've been shooting in front of you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the tear gas, they've been shooting them directly at people where it got in some people's heads, which right away killed them. And some people went right in their bodies and killed them right away. And people are not even being violent. They're not attacking. They're not destroying anything. Simply out there just protesting, holding an Iraqi flag.
Does that frighten you to see that happening around you while you're protesting? Does it make you want to go home?
No, to be honest, we got used to it. We've been dealing with that for decades. So to me, this is nothing. I mean, we were expecting it, honestly, but I was kind of shocked of this whole violence that's happening against us. Right now, we don't even want anything. We don't want the government in general. The government needs to resign.
I asked our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston what impact the nighttime curfew will have.
Well, the focal point of so much of the protest activity in Baghdad has been on the city's central square, Tahrir Square. There was an attempt by the security forces on Saturday night to clear it, but the protesters hung on and they're still there in this symbolically vital site in the heart of the city. Among those killed today in Baghdad was a young female medical student hit by a tear gas canister in the square. She's believed to be the first woman to die in the unrest this month that has claimed well over 200 lives. But this declaration of a curfew may well signal new intent by the government to jack up the pressure further still on the protesters, deploy the riot police even more forcefully between the hours at least of midnight and dawn, and perhaps the curfew will be used as justification for another attempt to clear that central square in the early hours of the morning.
And how else are the authorities responding to the unrest?
Well, remember that the protests have been driven by anger at corruption, the lack of jobs, dire public services, anger at the entire political establishment, which is regarded as ineffective and self-serving. Under this pressure, the government has promised to introduce reforms, and today the parliament was voting to begin that sort of process. MPs voted in favour of starting to reform the constitution, appointed a committee that's supposed to report back in 4 months or so. But all this was greeted with contempt by the powerful Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who has sided with the protesters. He told them not to be fooled. He said what was going on in parliament was a sham and that the corrupt in the elite needed to be brought to book.
Alan Johnston. A senior Democrat says the US House of Representatives will hold its first formal vote on the impeachment inquiry into President Trump on Thursday. The Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, said the resolution was necessary to ensure that there was no cover-up by the Trump administration into claims that the president put pressure on foreign governments to investigate his political rivals. Mrs. Pelosi says the resolution will eliminate any doubt as to whether the White House can withhold documents, disregard subpoenas, or prevent witnesses from giving testimony. Chris Buckler reports from Washington.
In a letter to other Democrats, Nancy Pelosi insisted a vote wasn't necessary to push forward with the impeachment inquiries. However, she said it was time to ensure that President Trump could not ignore the investigations, which are currently taking place before three congressional committees. Last week, some Republicans, who claim there has been a lack of transparency in the proceedings, disrupted and delayed a hearing that was being held behind closed doors. Mrs. Pelosi says this resolution will eliminate any doubt as to whether the White House can withhold documents, disregard subpoenas, or prevent witnesses from giving testimony.
Chris Buckler. Researchers have switched on a new telescope in the US state of Arizona, marking the start of the most ambitious study of the universe ever undertaken. Their aim is to learn about a mysterious substance called dark energy, and they say the results will radically transform our understanding of time and space. Palab Ghosh is our science correspondent, and I asked him, what is dark energy?
If I knew the answer to that, I'd have a Nobel Prize to my name. We don't know what dark energy is yet. This telescope will try and find out, but we know what it does. It's throwing the universe apart at an accelerating rate. And interestingly, the stuff that we see around us, you, me, the atoms, the Earth, all the observable universe, that just accounts for 5% of what's in the universe. Dark energy actually is a dominant force. It accounts for most of it, as Professor Ofer Lahav of UCL told me.
It's just embarrassing to live in a universe where we understand only 5% of it. Wouldn't you agree? I mean, how could we live in a universe knowing only 5% and not knowing about the other 95%? This is human curiosity. It would define our deeper understanding of physics. Right? The nature of that dark energy, what is it, may well lead to a whole revolution in physics, the whole of physics.
So tell us about this new telescope. What's so special about it?
Well, it's going to track in exquisite precision the acceleration of 35 million galaxies in the space of 5 years. It's able to scan so many galaxies in such a short space of time because it's got a big collecting dish. And inside the collecting dish are 5,000 fibre optics, each of which is a mini telescope able to track a galaxy and able to note down its speed and acceleration. And then once it's finished doing that, each fibre optic swivels round and focuses on 5,000 more. That's 5,000 every 20 minutes.
And how excited are scientists about this? I mean, could it change the way we think about physics?
Well, what they're waiting for is the results of these measurements of how fast the galaxies are accelerating apart from each other, and in particular, whether that acceleration has changed. And they want to find this out because there are more than 100 theories to explain dark energy. But once we've got this information, we can narrow that down. Some of them are quite esoteric, as Dr. Ashley Spindler of Hartford University told me.
So one of them is this idea that we aren't the only universe, that there is a multiverse out there of many different universes with different properties. And dark energy may be something that is leaking from these other universes into ours through the different dimensions and driving this expansion of galaxies in our universe.
So when will we get the information?
Well, it's a 5-year project to get these measurements. The number of possibilities for what could be causing dark energy will narrow down. I don't think we'll have the answer in 5 years, but we'll be a step closer.
Our science correspondent, Palab Ghosh. Robert Evans, the flamboyant and controversial Hollywood film producer, has died at the age of 89. Among the movies he worked on were Love Story, The Godfather and Chinatown. He was married 7 times and his wives included the film star Ali McGraw. And he wrote a frank autobiography in 1994 called The Kid Stays in the Picture. Lisa Mazimba looks back at his work.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
As a producer, Robert Evans won an Oscar nomination for Chinatown, the stylish film noir starring Jack Nicholson as a private detective in early 20th century Los Angeles. But Evans made his greatest impact when he became the head of Paramount Studios in the late 1960s. There, he oversaw films including the heist comedy The Italian Job, and the mafia drama The Godfather. He said he insisted on making the film longer than many at the studio wanted to ensure that it had meaning and impact.
I almost got fired for it. And instead of opening Christmas Day, we opened March 14th. Instead of the picture being 2 hours and 6 minutes, it was 2 hours and 56 minutes. Instead of being another mafia film, it made history.
He also oversaw Love Story. He married the film's star, Ali McGraw, during its production. And in 1994, he published a best-selling memoir about his time in Hollywood called The Kid Stays in the Picture.
Issa Mazimba on Robert Evans, who's died at the age of 89. We've already been talking about the latest Brexit extension, but how did we get to this point? And what's the best way of trying to explain what's going on with Britain's exit from the European Union? Well, take the BBC's most downloaded podcast, the Global News Podcast, and mash it up in a one-off special with the brilliant Brexit cast.
Hello, this is Jackie Leonard, and I'm here to say that once you've finished listening to this edition of the Global News Podcast, you might want to check out the special episode we recorded with the team from the BBC's Brexit cast. If you have questions about Brexit, you might just find some answers, and you will find them elsewhere in our feed. Now, though, back to today.
And look for the Global News Brexit cast a little further down the Global News Podcast feed. When US President Donald Trump described the death of Islamic State group leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, he did so in extraordinary detail, saying the man ran into a dead-end tunnel while being chased by military dogs. But senior military figures have been unable to confirm that version of events, saying al-Baghdadi killed himself by detonating an explosive vest. As our North American correspondent Nick Bryant explains, Mr. Trump has been eager to emphasise that the death of al-Baghdadi is a major victory for his administration.
Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's body has now been disposed of, in accordance, said the Pentagon, with the laws of armed conflict. But they've revealed no details about where and how. Military chiefs are still working on declassifying video footage and photographs from the raid. But significantly, they've been unable to confirm Donald Trump's account of Baghdadi's final moments and the president's description of him whimpering and crying in a tunnel moments before detonating an explosive vest. At the White House on Sunday, President Trump performed something of a victory lap, claiming the death of Baghdadi was even more significant than the death of Osama bin Laden, the biggest foreign policy success of his predecessor, Barack Obama. But when he attended a World Series baseball game in Washington last night, he was booed by the crowd when his name was announced in the stadium. The nation's capital is an overwhelmingly Democratic city. Presidents have been booed by baseball crowds in the past. But ordinarily, sports fans have shown more respect for the office of the presidency, regardless of its incumbent. This, then, was a voluble example of America's present polarization, which also offered more proof of the coarsening of public discourse that's accelerated under Donald Trump.
Nick Bryant reporting. Wildfires are continuing to cause destruction and havoc across California, with thousands of residents told to evacuate their homes. The state's governor, Gavin Newsom, has declared a state of emergency, and more than a million people have been left without electricity as power companies scramble to stop damaged cables from triggering new fires. Los Angeles council worker Paul Koretz issued a blunt warning to those thinking about staying put.
If you're in the mandatory evacuation zone and you're still there watching this, you're an idiot. Get the hell out. It's way too dangerous. People that stay behind are just endangering themselves and not helping.
One fire near the famous Getty Museum now threatens some of the state's most expensive homes. It's forced more people to leave, including the basketball star LeBron James, who has urged other residents to get out of the area. To find out more about how people are coping, the BBC's Chloe Tilley spoke to Jeremy Siegel, a science reporter at KPCC Public Radio in Los Angeles.
For people out here, you know, this is a familiar experience. This exact same area almost exactly 2 years ago saw an incredibly destructive firestorm just whip through the area, including parts of Santa Rosa. That killed more than 40 people. And a lot of the people who are evacuated right now are people who had to flee flee from their homes at that time. One thing I will say is that for people who have had to evacuate and for fire officials around here, the experience of that fire 2 years ago and also the experience of the deadly campfire that happened last November, it's made people start to prepare more for situations like this because it's becoming such a repetitive experience for residents of Northern California up here, having to evacuate from wildfires every year.
Well, Jeremy, that's what I wanted to ask you. How much warning would you get before you had to evacuate your home? Are people able to pack up their cars and drive out, or is it literally run for your lives?
It depends on the situation, and we're seeing that sort of change here in California a little bit. A big criticism in the aftermath of the 2017 fires and the campfire was that people did not get enough advance notice. What you saw here this weekend was that officials actually told people to evacuate before the fire was even coming close to moving into some areas, because when they were looking at models of winds, it looked like the fire could be pushing its way into those areas. So we're starting to see fire officials try to do more of these proactive evacuations so that people aren't literally running for their lives from the flames, and that it's more that they're having to leave their homes hours before the fire is even likely to reach that area.
And of course, we mustn't forget that this is exhausting and incredibly dangerous work for firefighters.
Yeah, absolutely. And even today, we've heard that there have been two firefighters who have been injured. One of them with minor burns, the other with more serious burns, had to be airlifted out of the firefighting zone to our state capital to be brought to a burn hospital there. So that's weighing heavy on firefighters. And, you know, a lot of these firefighters are the same people who worked on the campfire last year, who worked on the fires here 2 years ago. And they're certainly exhausted, just like the people who have had to evacuate are.
Jeremy Siegel. It's been 8 months since a Category 4 cyclone slammed into central Mozambique, leaving a trail of destruction and killing more than 1,000 people. Idai was the most severe cyclone ever to hit the southern hemisphere. And today, Mozambique is still struggling to recover from the storm that caused billions of dollars worth of damage. Here's the BBC's Shingai Nyuka.
Mozambique's road to recovery has been difficult. As we head to Mandruzi, one of the main resettlement camps for cyclone survivors, we pass along roads and bridges still under repair. Mozambique alone suffered almost $700 million in damage as a result of Idai, but the human cost was far greater. Children are among the thousands still living in plastic tents at the camp. They play soccer next to several of the dusty tents that we are told are the police station, the primary school, and the clinic. We met Elsa Koller as she proudly built herself a permanent home, wooden poles insulated with mud. She slaps the mud on with her hands. I ask her if she thinks it will withstand a cyclone.
It is up to God. I can say it will not hold, but God can help us, as he did the last time. Everybody here still lives in fear. Every time the wind blows, my children say, "Mom, the cyclone is coming back. Let's run away."
In the regional capital, Beira, people have started to resume their lives, catching fish to sell on the shore. But the city still bears the scars of Idai, apartment buildings and businesses with collapsed or blown off metal roofs. I'm standing in a Beira shanty town, one of the first places Idai hit. The 200 kilometer per hour wind speeds and 4 meter high waves flattened the flimsy shacks. The homes have since been rebuilt, but from the same corrugated metal sheets. And as a mild storm approaches, you can hear them rattling. If another cyclone were to hit, this township would be destroyed again. With close to 3,000 kilometers of coastline, storms are common here. There have been 5 severe cyclones in the last 20 years. But without proper building materials and environmental precautions, impoverished Mozambique once again remains ill-prepared for another cyclone.
Shingai Nyoka reporting. The pop superstar Prince seldom gave interviews, and when he did, journalists were not allowed to record them or even take notes. So it was a surprise in 2016 when he announced plans for his autobiography. 4 months later, he died, having only completed a first draft of the section about his childhood. He'd chosen the writer Dan Pipenbring to work with him on the project. Now Mr. Pipenbring has combined those pages with photos and other writings from Prince's archive to create a book called The Beautiful Ones, which is published on Tuesday. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson has been hearing what it was like to collaborate with Prince from Dan Pipenbring himself.
We've just heard reports that the American pop star Prince has died. He was 57.
The 21st of April 2016, just 4 days after Prince had been speaking to the writer Dan Pipenbring about his latest ideas for his autobiography.
He went into the thoughts he was having about his parents, and he said that one of his life's central dilemmas was figuring out what they meant to him and how he was living out their lives with his own. Maybe I'm just like my father, too bold. Maybe I'm just like my mother. I came away from that call with just a tremendous optimism and a sense that we were really about to do the heavy lifting on this project. And then, of course, it wasn't to be.
Why do you think he chose you to work on it? You were 29, you were white, mm-hmm. You'd never written a book.
Yeah, and I wasn't from Minneapolis. There is still to this day so much mystery surrounding that because in true Prince fashion, it's not as if he ever took me inside and said, well, Dan, here's why it was you.
Within a month, he was summoned to fly to Melbourne to join Prince on tour.
His bodyguard led me into his hotel suite where there was a legal pad sitting on a desk full of his handwriting, 30-some pages of it in pencil. These were the first pages of the memoir. They told the story of his childhood. And there's also a way in these pages that you learn just what it felt like to be in Prince's head. He, from a very young age, had this peculiarity to him, this individuality.
And while writing about his thoughts on radio, Prince took a pot shot at an unlikely British target. He says, they keep trying to ram Katy Perry and Ed Sheeran down our throats, and we don't like it, no matter how many times they play it. What's he got with Ed Sheeran?
To be honest, I was so much in agreement with him on that subject that there didn't seem to be any more to say about it at the time.
After Prince's death, it was presumed the book was over. However, his estate invited Dan into Paisley Park to look through Prince's archive of photos and family memorabilia. The decision was made to publish what Prince had started. And as for how the book would have turned out if he'd lived, well, Prince had ambitious ideas about what it could achieve, even solving racism.
Yes, I mean, it really stopped me in my tracks to sit in a room with him and lock eyes with him. Something that feels impossible in any other context suddenly feels natural or I mean, it makes you kind of bristle with excitement. But there's definitely a sadness and a sense of wonder in everything that he didn't get to say.
That report from Colin Patterson. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.